of the English faculty here at UTC and of the C.S. Lewis Lecture Planning Committee. On behalf of the Planning Committee and the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, I would like to welcome you to our 18th annual C.S. Lewis Lecture. I want to express my appreciation to all the members of the Planning Committee whose names you'll find listed on your brochure. I also want to thank our co-sponsors, and you'll find them listed in the brochure also. Special appreciation, though, is due the Chattanooga Christian Community Foundation and the Speakers and Special Events Committee of the University because they provided funding for this event. I feel especially privileged to be able to introduce our speaker for tonight, Lucy Shaw. Ms. Shaw is regarded by many as the finest living Christian poet. She is also, or has been, a teacher, an essayist, editor, publisher, lector, supply preacher. Our brochure contains a list of her major published works and other details about her education and background. Her papers are housed at Wheaton College, along with those of C.S. Lewis and a number of other significant Christian writers. In 1998, she was a speaker at the C.S. Lewis Summer Institute at Oxford University. In her foreword to her collection of poems called The Siding, Mrs. Shaw writes, "The words seer and prophet describe the double identity of the biblical spokesman who sees looking toward heaven, receiving a vision, and then prophesies to earth and its population, proclaiming the oracle. The Christian poet stands alongside the seer and prophet, one foot in heaven, one on earth, trying to face in both directions at once, perpetually torn by this duality of focus as divine dreams are channeled through his eyes and ears to his voice or pen." She goes on to say, "As visionaries called by God's name, we," talking about poets and artists, "have a responsibility to discern whether our insights line up with God's special revelation, the Holy Scriptures, where the nihilistic artist is often a prophet of the absurd and the random, seeing only distortion, fragmentation, perversity, and despair. The Christian poet is permitted a sighting of a different nature. While frankly acknowledging struggle, pain, and the reality of the ugly, by writing honestly out of the shattered places of his own life, the believing poet affirms that anguish and disorder are fragments of a larger landscape, that God is an artist, a designer, an architect who calls us back to the strong beauty of wholeness and order and felicity in Christ. The temptation, of course, is for us to dream our own dreams, to see only what we want to see, to fall in love with our own words and the sounds of our own voices, to become deaf to the voice of God and blind to his signs and symbols, to emphasize our own originality, forgetting that God is the only true original. That is why the imitation of Christ contains a proviso within the promise. If your heart is straight with God, then every creature will be to you a mirror of life and a book of holy doctrine." Lucy Shaw's work clearly mirrors life and reflects holy doctrine. What a privilege it is for us to have such an outstanding contemporary visionary as Lucy Shaw speak about the poetry of another of our great visionaries, C.S. Lewis. Please welcome Lucy Shaw.
It's a great privilege for me to be here tonight. And no thanks is due to United Airlines. However, it's the part of the poet to survive rejection and difficulty in our culture. So I'm going to talk tonight about Lewis's poetry because his poetry has come to life for me in an extraordinary way. I've read most of his poems, dozens of times. They still never fail to move me and to speak truth to me. And I love the way most good poetry is multi-layered. You may receive one layer of truth at a time, but as with Scripture, the more you read it, the more you discover, the more you see. In C.S. Lewis's novel, Till We Have Faces, Orwell, Queen of Gloam, the heroine of the tale, is retelling a bedtime story song that she used to hear as a child from the fox, the royal family's tutor. She recalls how the fox deepened and lilted his voice and told how Aphrodite, Greek goddess of love and beauty, once fell in love with the prince Anchises while he kept his father's sheep on the slopes of a mountain called Ida. And as she came down the grassy slopes towards the shepherd's hut, lions and lynxes and bears and all sorts of beasts came about her, fawning like dogs, and all went from her again in pairs to the delights of love. But Aphrodite dimmed her glory and made herself like a mortal woman and came to Anchises and beguiled him, and they went up together into his bed. Here Orwell pauses and says, "I think the fox meant to end here, but the song now had him in its grip." And he went on to tell what followed, how Anchises woke from sleep and saw Aphrodite standing in the door of the hut, not now like a mortal, but with the glory. So he knew he had lain with a goddess, and he covered his eyes and shrieked, "Kill me at once." "Not that this ever really happened," the fox said in haste. "It's only lies of poets, child, not in accordance with nature." Orwell goes on, "It was always like that with the fox. He was ashamed of loving poetry. All folly, child," he would say. "And I had to work much at my reading and writing, and what he called philosophy, in order to get a poem out of him. But thus, little by little, he taught me many." The real lilt came into his voice and the real brightness into his eyes when we were off into "Take me to the apple-laden land," or "The moon's gone down, but alone I lie." Even the fox, the supreme rationalist, Lewis's personification of logic and philosophic principle, could be aroused and stirred by the romanticism and the emotion of poetry. And reading between the lines, we suspect that Lewis is hinting in this narrative at his own true love, the poetic direction of his own heart. It seems as if, for both the fox and his creator, Lewis, a prosaic statement reflecting duty, reason, good sense, intelligence, and even wit was not enough. In presenting only half the story, it even displays a kind of falsehood. What was needed for true truth, in Lewis's phrase, was the seasoning of poetry, the heights and depths of feeling, delight, tenderness, melancholy, conflict and resolution, colors and shadows and light, to bring an abstract principle to life and flesh it out in our imaginations. We have all experienced the sense that intelligence and practicality alone are unsatisfactory, inadequate. No matter how forceful an expository sermon is, our ears prick up when a story is introduced to turn it three-dimensional, presenting the idea in living color and texture. Somehow, reason alone has a flatness to which only imagination and metaphor can add the interest of peaks and valleys. The monochromatic quality of scholarly lecture cries out for illustration. It's much like our impulse to whistle or sing when mere speaking cannot express our exhilaration, or the urge to dance and skip when walking is too staid a pace for our exuberance. I must say I haven't done a lot of skipping lately. In his book, An Experiment in Criticism, Lewis tells us, "To regard the poem as primarily philosophical is an outrage to the thing the poet has made for us." Until the last couple of decades, very few people were aware that Lewis wrote poetry. With the exception of the two youthful volumes that appeared in 1919, during his lifetime, his poems had appeared only in his allegorical The Pilgrim's Regress and a handful of periodicals such as The Spectator, The Oxford Magazine, Time and Tide, and Punch. And he wrote under the transparent pseudonym of Clive Hamilton, his first name and his mother's maiden name of Hamilton, or Nat Wilk, which is Anglo-Saxon for I know not whom, a very anonymous name. But in 1964, after his death, Lewis's poems were collected, edited, and published by Walter Hooper, who added a fine and instructive preface to the volume. Lewis was brought up as a British schoolboy on the classical poets. The scansion of Latin and Greek lyrics would have constituted a major part of his literary education. He would have been all too familiar with alcaics and asclepiads and hendecasyllabics, and with the formal metrics of poets such as Pindar, Ovid, Aeschylus, Euripides, Homer, and Lucretius. His own natural sense for rhythms and words and his growing aesthetic sensibility would have come into play early in life, and he quite naturally aspired from his teens and into his early 30s to become a poet, a great poet. His early writings were, however, immature, derivative, and uneven in quality. Spirits in Bondage, published in 1919 when he was 20 years old, was characterized by idealism and a veritable cascade of literary and mythological allusions without one well-developed or truly imaginative theme. His longer poems, now republished under the title Narrative Poems, also edited by Hooper, consisted of Dymer, Lancelot, The Nameless Isle, and The Queen of Drum. In view of his later conversion to Christianity, it is interesting to note with Chad Walsh that in these poems written by a young atheist, God is remarkably alive. Just as Christian Milton wrote as though strings of pagan deities actually existed, so young pagan Lewis allowed God into his verse. Of particular interest is the development in The Queen of Drum of the character of the archbishop. In the poem, this prelate had, for 15 years or more, closed his eyes to the court's corruption. But challenged by the queen, he confesses his true belief and ends the story as a Christian martyr with these words, "I yet believe, if such a word on these soiled lips be not absurd, that from the place beyond all ken, only one word has come to men and was incarnate and had hands and feet and walked in earthly lands and died and rose. And nothing more will come or ever came before with certainty. Go, learn your catechism and your creed. Mark what I say, not how I live, and for myself may God forgive." For an atheist, prior to his conversion, that was a remarkable characterization. Lewis's theology was, at this stage, decidedly unsystematic. He had as yet no compelling focus for his vision, and though he was enthralled from time to time to Sehnsucht, a longing for the numinous, he vacillated between conflicting philosophical stances. His early poetic efforts received little critical notice, and it is perhaps this lack of acclaim which nudged Lewis to turn to prose, academic essay, fiction, apologetics, philosophy, allegory, letters, and literary criticism, the genres for which he is celebrated today. He became very much the private poet, one who would willingly share his verses with intimate friends, colleagues, and correspondents, but whose desire for recognition as a poet had been blunted probably by his lack of public success. His imaginative impulse never faded, but it seems as if these shorter poems were written in the cracks of his life, as it were, between the preparation of his major literary works and his professorial duties as a don at Oxford and later at Cambridge. Lewis's conversion to theism in 1929 and to full-fledged Christian belief in 1931 solved more than just a spiritual philosophical dilemma for him. It brought into three-dimensional focus his aesthetic sense. After the yearnings of his early life and his search for an elusive joy, one of the themes of the Pilgrim's Regress, the joy that found him and filled his vision is the joy that informs and transforms his later poems. In the introduction to George MacDonald, An Anthology, Lewis speaks of his first discovery of MacDonald's Fantasties and of the celebrated change it made in his life. "I knew that I had crossed a frontier. What it actually did to me was to convert, even to baptize, my imagination. The quality which had enchanted me in MacDonald's imaginative works turned out to be the quality of the real universe, the divine, magical, terrifying, and ecstatic reality in which we all live." Thomas Howard, in his book, The Achievement of C.S. Lewis, writes, "It is not that poetry or the poetic imagination uncovers some arcane significance in things that a cloddish scientific analysis cannot hope to see. Rather, the poetic imagination wants to speak with a language that charts how we mortals see these phenomena, the thing implicit in the poetry all along being that there is perhaps no truer way to speak of the phenomena." It is my firm belief that in his later poetry, Lewis found a medium so closely attuned to his own spirit, to his own way of seeing things, that it enabled him to speak truly of any phenomenon that caught the attention of his baptized imagination. In the years that followed, Lewis wrote constantly, often alternating between prose and verse, seemingly pulled in both directions as he struggled to attach words to ideas and images. Though both Till We Have Faces and Surprised by Joy started out as poems, one ended up as a novel and the other as prose autobiography. As his prose works began to waken an increasingly avid and eager audience, his creative energies were increasingly devoted to writing the more than 40 volumes in various prose forms for which he has become so widely known and popular. But Lewis continued to write poems. 16 of these first appeared in The Pilgrim's Regress, published in 1933. It's fascinating to watch how, as this allegorical narrative develops, Lewis finds it more and more necessary to speak in poetry. At the book's beginning, poems appear rarely, every 50 pages or more. The pace quickens, and by the book's end, one or two poems appear on nearly every page. For Lewis, the thrust of metaphor seemed to deal a more telling blow than the most lucid narrative prose. One such poem on prayer ends with the lines, "Take not, O Lord, our literal sense, but in thy great unbroken speech, our halting metaphor translate." Lewis's mastery of the balance between the form and the content of poetry grew with the years. As he himself observed in his preface to Paradise Lost, "The man who writes a good love sonnet needs not only to be enamored of a woman, but also to be enamored of the sonnet." He was a poet in the original sense of the word, a maker, a writer who could quite consistently tap a deep and brilliant imagination and shape his images into stanzas that waken our own imaginative response. As Chad Walsh, one of his early critics, put it, he had many things going for him. The discipline of the craft, a storehouse of allusions gathered from his wide reading. And he was a writer who wrestled with questions that matter, that resonate with all of us. Ruth Pitter, the first woman poet to have won the Queen's Medal for Poetry, and a good friend of Lewis, said that he had a great stock of the makings of a poet: strong visual memory, strong recollections of childhood, desperately strong yearning for lost paradise and hoped for heaven. Not least, a strong primitive intuition of the diabolical. In fact, his whole life was oriented and motivated by an almost uniquely persisting child's sense of glory and of nightmare. The adult events were received into a medium still as pliable as wax, wide open to the glory, and equally vulnerable, with a man's strength to feel it all, and a great scholar's and writer's skills to express and interpret. Added to that were his wit or quickness of fancy, an appreciation of the ludicrous, as well as his perception of the correspondences that linked natural phenomena and spiritual or eternal truths. But was C.S. Lewis able to achieve his youthful dream of being a great poet? Perhaps we should ask, first of all, what we expect of a great poet. First, we're on the alert for the appearance and reappearance of themes which will speak to the imagination of any age. Give Lewis 5 stars on a scale of 5 to 1 for that. As Walsh said, he deals with life, death, meaning, emptiness, God, Satan, love, to which great poetry gravitates. Then we hope to see those primal themes tied down to earth with the concrete detail that exhibits an understanding of the lives and daily concerns of humanity and is expressed in vivid sensual and visual images. Lewis scores high here, too. In On Being Human, he describes the nature of an angel's penetrating intelligence and contrasts it with that human beings. I'm going to project this on the screen and read it to you because I feel you need to experience Lewis's poetry rather than just hearing me talk about it. At least it may help you to catch some of the sense. I like the double exposure of hearing and seeing a poem at once. I think it enters the imagination more effectively that way. On Being Human. Angelic minds, they say, by simple intelligence, behold the forms of nature. They discern unerringly the archetypes, all the verities which mortals lack or indirectly learn. Transparent in primordial truth, unvarying, pure earthness and right stonehood from their clear high eminence are seen. Unveiled, the seminal huge principles appear. The treeness of the tree they know, the meaning of arboreal life, how from the earth's salty lap the solar beam uplifts it, all the holiness enacted by leaves fall and rising sap. But never an angel knows the knife-edged severance of sun from shadow where the trees begin, the blessed cool at every pore caressing us. An angel has no skin. They see the form of air, but mortals breathing it drink the whole summer down into the breast. The lavish pinks, the field new mown, the ravishing sea smells, the wood fire smoke that whispers rest, the tremor on the rippled pool of memory that from each smell in widening circles goes, the pleasure and the pang, can angels measure it? An angel has no nose. The nourishing of life and how it flourishes on death and why, they utterly know. But not the hill-born earthy spring, the dark, cold bilberries, the ripe peach from the southern wall still hot, full-bellied tankards foamy-topped, the delicate half-lyric lamb, a new loaf's billowing curves, nor porridge, nor the tingling taste of oranges. An angel has no nerves. Far richer they. I know the senses which regards us like air from heavens too big to see. Imminent death to man, that barbed sublimity and dazzling edge of beauty unsheathed would be. Yet here, within this tiny charmed interior, this parlor of the brain, their maker shares with living men some secrecy, some secrets in a privacy forever ours, not theirs. Notice the recurring instances of what Lewis himself called, in another poem, the tether and pang of the particular. The cold bilberries, the warm peach, the difference between sun and shadow. That's where it speaks to our own intelligence and our experience. Third, a great poet will continue over a lifetime to develop as an artist. With maturity should come depth, confidence, strength, profound insight, an unselfconscious authority and consistency without monotony, all of which Lewis's later poems exhibited. Fourth, there must be quantity as well as quality, a body of work growing to significant proportions over the years. And here we pause, for the poetic works in print comprise only 3 volumes, of which only the last seems destined to stand on its own merits. Fifth, a great poet must be, in some sense, a pioneer, working close to the cutting edge of innovation, attempting the original, the untried, the experimental, the stylistic branching out. But when we look at the well-known poets of Lewis's time, Auden, Eliot, Spender, McNeice, Graves, Pound, Stevens, William Carlos Williams, we see that Lewis was moving in another direction. Where Eliot used strikingly obverse, clinical, often ugly imagery and personae to set his scene and people his stage, Lewis, the romantic, chose traditional images already rich with archetypal associations. In the poem, A Confession, he gently mocks Eliot's famous line about a sunset that is like a patient etherized upon a table. Lewis even concocts some of his own existential images, perhaps to show that he can when he wants to. A Confession. I am so coarse, the things the poets see are obstinately invisible to me. For 20 years I've stared my level best to see if evening, any evening, would suggest a patient etherized upon a table. In vain, I simply wasn't able. To me, each evening looked far more like the departure from a silent yet a crowded shore of a ship whose freight was everything, leaving behind gracefully, finally, without farewells, marooned mankind. Here's another existential image. Red dawn behind a hedgerow in the east, never for me, resembled in the least a chilblain on a cocktail shaker's nose. Waterfalls don't remind me of torn underclothes, nor glaciers of tin cans. I've never known the moon look like a humpbacked crone. Rather, a prodigy, even now not naturalized, a riddle glaring from the cyclops' brow of the cold world, reminding me on what a place I crawl and cling, a planet with no bulwarks out in space. Never the white of the wintriest day struck me as un crachat d'estaminet, a streak of spittle. I'm like that odd man Wordsworth knew, to whom a primrose was a yellow primrose, one whose doom keeps him forever in the list of dunces, compelled to live on stock responses, making the poor best that I can of dull things, peacocks, honey, the Great Wall, Aldebaran, silver weirs, new-cut grass, wave on the beach, hard gem, the shapes of horse and woman, Athens, Troy, Jerusalem. Lewis country is, in the words of Thomas Howard, the country hinted at and guessed at and dreamed of and longed for in all tales of joy and merriment and homecoming and reunion and harmony. Arcadia and the Garden of the Hesperides and the land of the Hyperboreans and Narnia are like good dreams. To be sure, often the shafts of light from the real country fall on the jungle of filth and imbecility that is, alas, our imagination, so that you get chaos and lechery and perfidy romping through the stories. But back of it all shimmers the dream of primeval and everlasting bliss and the aching desire for that bliss. Though discouraged and critical of the mechanistic mindset and trajectory of the burgeoning of modern technology and scientific enterprise of his day, what would he think of ours? Despair found no voice in Lewis. As a traditionalist, he seemed to be facing directly away from that, from the nihilistic vision of other poets of his time. He says things like this: "If a quack doctor's breezy ineptitude has cost me a leg, must I forget straightway all that I can't do now, all that I could?" So when our guides unanimously decry the backward glance, I think we can guess why. As Clyde Kilby has said, Lewis thinks we shall have a truer image of humanity if we view ourselves beset by the dim memory of a lost Eden than as on our way upward from an evolutionary ancestry. Kilby continues, Lewis's objections to what he called chronological snobbery, modern runaway commercialism, humanicidal adjustedness, and triviality are all here. He sees the world full of machinery and movement, but in fact limping towards a condition of thinness and abstraction. The very play of mind, I think, is birth controlled today, is how Lewis put it. Sheldon Van Auken called Lewis the unfashionable poet, and I would echo that. Finally, in our list of the attributes of a great poet, there must be a magic at work. For as Calvin Linton has said, one cannot really explain how authentic poems work, for they work by magic, producing effects surpassing their visible means. A poem's unique magic is like human life. Dissect the body, and it's gone. It will not yield its essence to ruthless analysis. Lewis's imagination spoke the unspeakable and revealed the invisible. Walter Hooper affirms, his wonderful imagination is the guiding thread. Everything he touched had his kind of magic about it. His poetry, like his prose, is teeming with ideas and the good fruits of humor, wit, common sense, and scholarship. Though Lewis's poetic output was limited, we see by hindsight that its importance, when set against the rest of his work, is great. Good poetry being what it is, the concentration of an idea or image to its essence, the crystallization in words of imagination and experience, the marriage of music and metaphor, a paring away of the non-essential so that every word and phrase has weight and carries significance, with the meaning of the whole being hinted at in the part. These poems are not only evocative in themselves, they help us in our comprehension of the larger Lewis oeuvre. As we read the poems, after studying and relishing his other works, we will see his world with a clearer vision, being reminded in a score of vivid ways that this is what Lewis believed about myth, or modern technology, or progressive education, and that is how he perceived pain and love and bereavement, hell and heaven, the nature of God. As we read this poetry, we feel surprise and delight at the reappearance of some familiar friends: talking animals, monopods, dwarves, unicorns, dragons, Wormwood of Screwtape Letters, if he can be called a friend, angels, elves, space travelers, giants, a phoenix, mythical places such as Tellus, Numenor, Atlantis, the Utter East, as well as the personae of literary and mythological history, names like Homer, Milton, Circe, Pindar, Paracelsus, Jove, Pan, Demeter, the Cyclops, the North Wind, Hermione, Heracles, Pallas Athene, Psyche, Lilith, all of them shine on the pages, and you will be reintroduced to Chirico, Coleridge, Scott, Marvell, Wordsworth, Charles Williams, Beatrix Potter, and Kenneth Graham. Biblical characters abound: Adam, Noah and his sons, Solomon, Sennacherib, Stephen, Lazarus. And the people of the Bible are heard to be in conversations with the mythic ones. Adam listens to the drums of the dwarves. Noah encounters a unicorn. They all seem to mingle in the same imaginary world of the Lewis mind. The way to understand and enter this poet's work is not just by way of the mind, however, although he exercises our mental faculties to the limit, but by way of the heart and the imagination. A poem may fail to come to life even though it fulfills all the objective criteria for poetry. But if it moves us and illuminates us and wakes in us that peculiar pang of recognition that comes with vision, perhaps we can say that it succeeds. Perhaps after hearing and experiencing the power of Lewis's poetry, you will join me facing Eden, listening to him say, in Tom Howard's words, "Ahoy, over this way, you're headed in the wrong direction. Here's a whole world you have forgotten." Now, I want to expose you to some more of Lewis's poetry because this is really where he comes to life for me. I'm going to read quite a spectrum of work here, some of it whimsical, some of it very serious. So just join me in an appreciation of his own particular gift in poetry. Narnian Suite. March for strings, kettle drum, and 63 dwarfs. With plucking pizzicato and the prattle of the kettle drum, we're trotting into battle mid a clatter of accoutrement. Our beards are big as periwigs and trickle with a popinax, and trinketry and treasure twinkle out of every part of us. Scrape, tap, the fiddle and the kettle drum. The chuckle-headed humans think we're only petty puppetry, and all our battle tackle, nothing more than pretty bric-a-brac. But a little shrub has prickles, and they'll soon be in a pickle if a scud of dwarfish archery has crippled all their cavalry. Whiz, twang, the quarrel and the javelin. And when the tussle thickens, we can writhe and wriggle under it. Then dagger point'll tickle 'em, and grab and gripple grapple 'em, and trap and trickle trouble 'em, and tackle 'em, and topple 'em, till they're huddled, all bediddled, in the middle of our capering. Dodge, jump, the wriggle, and the somersault. When we've scattered 'em and peppered 'em with pebbles from our catapults, we'll turn again in triumph, and by crannies and by crevices, we'll go back to where the capital and cradle of our people is, our forges and our furnaces, the caverns of the earth, gold, fire, the anvil, and the smithying. Here's one Cole says, somewhere in his writing tells us, a gnome moves through earth like an arrow in the air, at home like a fish within the seamless, foamless liberty of the water that yields to it everywhere. Beguiled with pictures, I fancied in my childhood subterranean rivers beside glimmering wharfs, hammers upon anvils pattering and yammering, torches and tunnels, the cities of the dwarfs. But in perfect blackness underneath the surface, in a silence unbroken till the planet cracks, their sinewy bodies through the dense continuum move without resistance and leave no cracks. Gravel, marl, blue clay, all's one to travel in. Only one obstacle can impede a gnome, a cave or a mine shaft. Not their very bravest would venture across it for a shortcut home. There is the unbridgeable. To a gnome, the air is utter vacuity. If he thrust out his face into a cavern, his face would break in splinters, bursting as a man would in interstellar space. With toiling lungs, a gnome can breathe the soil in. Rocks are a headwind, stiff against his chest. Chief midst his pleasures is the quiet leaf mold, like air in meadowy valleys when the wind's at rest. Like sylvan freshness are the loads of silver. Cold, clammy, fog-like are the leaden veins. Those of gold are prodigally sweet like roses. Gems stab coolly like the small spring rains. The day with a white mark. I think all of us have experienced something like this. All day I have been tossed and whirled in a preposterous happiness. Was it an elf in the blood or a bird in the brain, or even part of the cloudily crested 50-league-long, loud, uplifted wave of a journeying angel's transit roaring over and through my heart. My garden's spoiled. My holidays are canceled. The omens harden. The planned and unplanned miseries deepen. The knots draw tight. Reason kept telling me all day my mood was out of season. It was, too. In the dark ahead, the breakers only are white. Yet I could have kissed the very scullery taps. The color of my day was like a peacock's chest. In at each sense there stole ripplings and dewy sprinkles of delight that with them drew fine threads of memory through the vibrant thickness of the soul. As though they were transparent earths and luminous trees should grow there, and shining roots worked visibly far down below one's feet. So everything, the tick of the clock, the cock crowing in the yard, probing my soil, woke diverse buried hearts of mine to beat, recalling either adolescent heights and the inaccessible longings and ice-sharp joys that shook my body and turned me pale, or humbler pleasures, chuckling, as it were, in the ear, mumbling of glee, as kindly animals talk in a children's tale. Who knows if it will ever come again, now that the day closes? No one can give me or take away that key. All depends on the elf, the bird, or the angel. I doubt if the angel himself is free to choose when sudden heaven in man begins or ends. Sudden heaven. I think we know what he's talking about there. Okay, here's one called The Late Passenger. Wonderful story. The sky was low, the sounding rain was falling dense and dark, and Noah's sons were standing in the window of the ark. The beasts were in, but Japhet said, "I see one creature more, belated and unmated, there, come knocking at the door." "Well, let him knock," said Ham, "or let him drown or learn to swim. We're overcrowded as it is. We've got no room for him." "And yet it knocks, how terribly it knocks," said Shem. "Its feet are hard as horn, but oh, the air that comes from it is sweet." "Now hush," said Ham, "you'll waken Dad. And once he comes to see what's at the door, it's sure to mean more work for you and me." Noah's voice came roaring from the darkness down below. "Some animal is knocking. Take it in before we go." Ham shouted back, and savagely he nudged the other two. "It's only Japhet knocking down a brad nail with his shoe." Said Noah, "Boys, I hear a noise that's like a horse's hoof." Said Ham, "Why, that's the dreadful rain that drums upon the roof." Noah tumbled up on deck, and out he put his head. His face went gray. His eyes, his knees were loosed. He tore his beard and said, "Look, look, it would not wait. It turns away. It takes its flight. Fine work you've made of it, my sons, between you all tonight. Even if I could outrun it now, it would not turn again. Not now. Our great discourtesy has earned its high disdain. O noble and unmated beast, my sons were all unkind. In such a night, what stable and what manger will you find?" O golden hoofs, O cataracts of mane, O nostrils wide with indignation, oh, the neck wave-arched, the lovely pride. Oh, long shall be the furrows plowed across the hearts of men before it comes to stable and to manger once again. And dark and crooked all the ways in which our race shall walk, and shriveled all their manhood like a flower with broken stalk. And all the world, O Ham, may curse the hour when you were born. Because of you, the ark must sail without the unicorn. Eden's courtesy. Such natural love 'twixt beast and man we find, The children all desire an animal book. And all brutes, not perverted from their kind, woo us with whinny, tongue, tail, song, or look. So much of Eden's courtesy yet remains. But when a creature's dread or mind has built a wall between, I think I feel the pains that Adam earned and do confess my guilt. For till I tame sly fox and timorous hare and lording lion in myself, no peace can be without. But after I shall dare uncage the shadowy zoo, and war will cease, because the brutes within, I do not doubt, are archetypal of the brutes without. Of Lewis's most poignant poems, Charles Williams was his intimate friend, one of the Inklings, one of the colleagues who would gather frequently, share their work, drink their beer, smoke their pipes, and think big thoughts. And when Williams died, as you'll see, Lewis wanted to talk to someone about this bereavement, and the only one he wanted to talk to was Charles Williams.